Welcome to our Holden Village podcast. For over 50 years now, Holden Village has traveled a rich history of faith that has transformed a copper mining town into a vibrant place of education, programming, and worship. Holden has sought to welcome all who seek contemplation and community in the remote wilderness of the beautiful Cascade Mountains. We continue to invite people of all ages to come alongside our rhythms, which inspire and equip travelers for a sustainable life of faith outside the village. And we continue to listen and reflect on our story and history and seek to discover our place in God's creative mission in our world. Our podcasts are a way of sharing our conversations with our teaching faculty around reformation, the reforming of our relationships with the earth, with each other, and with the divine. Let's tune in and join the conversation.
My name is Chris Voss Rothmeyer, and I'm here at Holden this week teaching a class on the history of racism. I'm a middle school teacher in Gresham, Oregon, and a Presbyterian pastor, and I'd like to talk about the history of racism. Let's first define racism. Basically, it's when one person or group prejudges another person or group based on skin color and uses that judgment to exercise power over them. At least that's the way many people think about racism. But racism can be broken down into three categories: personal, as I just defined, institutional, and cultural. An example of individual racism is when an employer looks at a name on a resume, thinks that the name sounds Hispanic or African American, and decides not to interview that person. Institutional racism moves out of the realm of personal interaction and into the way institutions work. Organizations can use policies, programs, and procedures to benefit white people and disadvantage people of color. These policies are usually unintentional. An example: people of color are very underrepresented in movies and TV. Another example: standardized tests ask questions that favor a certain cultural upbringing and perspective. And these tests are then used to screen applicants for admittance to college and university. Another example: reliance on low-paying undocumented immigrant labor by farms and factories. There's also cultural racism, which speaks to the ways that a dominant culture, white culture in the U.S., defines norms and values and beliefs to their advantage and to the disadvantage of others. An example: thin and white are the basis for our society's definition of beauty. Black or brown women on welfare are assumed to be lazy and irresponsible, while white-collar fraud that costs the U.S. hundreds of billions of dollars each year is excused. Most explorers, scientists, and inventors that people can name, if they go through our public education system, are white, bolstering the belief that white accomplishments are the most important. These three must be understood in order to have a basic conversation about the history of racism. By these definitions, racism has not been around all that long, only a little bit more than 500 years. Ancient cultures did not use race, skin color, as the basis for power and control. Certainly, they exercised power over others, but skin color was not the controlling factor. It became the controlling factor as Europeans began exploring and exploiting cultures in Africa, Asia, North and South America, beginning in the 1400s. In a sense, says James Loewen, there was no Europe before 1492. And for that matter, there were no white people before 1492. Since the downfall of the Roman Empire in the late 5th century, medieval Europeans were a scattered group of often warring tribes who gained a definition of themselves only when they began to look beyond their borders. Early Renaissance artists and thinkers in the 1300s rediscovered ancient Greece and Rome through Spanish contact with Muslims who had retained artifacts and ideas from these rich Muslim cultures. Having thus formed the basis of a cultural identity, the rise of European wealth through a newly urbanized middle class, and the desire to market products outside Europe fueled exploration beyond its borders. As monarchs funded expensive voyages to other continents to foster trade in the early 1400s, they did so not with the desire to gain cultural understanding or engage in a mutual exchange of goods and ideas, but to amass wealth gain earthly glory, and even secure spiritual salvation. In 1503, Christopher Columbus wrote to the King and Queen of Spain. He said, "Gold is most excellent, and he who has it does all he wants in the world, and can even lift souls up to paradise." Everything outside of Europe, therefore, was seen as a means of increasing wealth. The Portuguese began exploring the African coast in the 1430s, and shortly thereafter began to take slaves from there back to Europe. The numbers weren't high, but the transatlantic slave trade had begun. Columbus, of course, went across the Atlantic in a different direction, westward toward the Americas. He found some gold, but only in limited amounts. When Columbus did not find what he hoped for, he turned to another commodity that would return a dividend to his benefactors, people. In his writings, it's clear that Columbus viewed these people in two ways, ripe for conversion and ripe for exploitation. All right, well, let's skip forward in time to the 1600s. Slavery was obviously in place as it had been for millennia. Now it involved multiple continents and an ever-widening diversity of cultures and races. Africans and indigenous peoples of North and South America were seen by Europeans in this new international arena as chattel, property to be bought and sold. And Europe, as a regional group, now defined as a competitive desire to colonize the rest of the world and extract wealth from it, was clearly in control economically. The stage was set for the race-based exercise of power, but location, that is anything outside of Europe, rather than race, was the basis for exploitation. That began to change in Jamestown. Jamestown, in modern-day Virginia, was the first permanent English colony in the Americas. In 1607, about 100 Englishmen voyaged to the New World in order to gain wealth. After a very few difficult years and the near destruction of Jamestown due to disease, famine, and conflict with the surrounding native populations, the settlers realized that tobacco grew very well in Virginia. But tobacco is a labor-intensive crop, and very few of the original English settlers were used to getting their hands dirty. Africans who first arrived in 1619 and poor Europeans were employed as indentured servants for the purpose of tending the crops. And then in 1640, John Punch, an African indentured servant, was sentenced to life in permanent servitude for the crime of running away. Two other men also ran away with him, but they were given a much lighter sentence. Both men were white. Mr. Punch is considered to be the first official slave in the English colonies. Many historians also view this case as a landmark ruling that set a distinction between Europeans and Africans, as well as a milestone in the development of the institution of slavery in the U.S. Since tobacco, English tobacco, and later cotton were labor-intensive and in high demand in Europe, the need for increased labor further fanned the flames of slavery, and high profits made many white Europeans, slave owners and non-slave owners alike, very wealthy. So over the next 225 years, of course, slavery became an integral part of life in the colonies, and later, the United States. Ultimately, this system could not last, and our country fought a terrible civil war that ended it. While the institution of slavery ended, however, the foundation upon which it stood, racism, did not. And so, shortly after the Civil War ended, slavery was replaced with another institution that sought to keep African Americans and, by association, others of a darker skin color than Europeans at the bottom, sharecropping. While sharecropping was voluntary, former slaves and some poor white farmers found themselves in a cycle of debt that they could not escape. By 1900, the vast majority of sharecroppers in the South were African American. And then in 1896, the Supreme Court declared that colored public facilities and services should be separate but equal to white facilities. The ensuing Jim Crow laws made sure that dark-skinned people knew their place in society. And from the turn of the century until the 1950s, Jim Crow laws defined the way of life, intended to separate whites from everyone else, in a way that certainly was not equal. As the renewed civil rights era gained momentum in the 1950s, Jim Crow could not continue to openly put down people of color, with signs designating some bathrooms, waiting rooms, schools, and seats on buses for whites, and others for blacks. And so Jim Crow laws also went out of favor. But once again, racism as an institution remained strongly entrenched in our society. Racist attitudes found a new way to keep those of a darker skin color in control without being overtly racist. When Lyndon Johnson declared a war on drugs in the 1960s, his presidential successors echoed the call. But it wasn't until the 1980s that the mass incarceration of drug offenders using tough-on-crime language as a political justification began to fill local, state, and federal prisons to overflowing. And the U.S. saw hundreds of new for-profit prisons pop up all over the country. Today, we imprison far more people than any other industrialized nation. More than 2 million people are behind bars today, 10 times the number in 1968. And over 7 million are currently on probation or parole. The vast majority of those under correctional control are there on drug charges. And the vast majority of those arrested in the war on drugs are black and brown skinned. So racism has changed forms several times in the last 500 years, but in all its forms, personal, institutional, and cultural, it always seeks to place people of color in a lower position in society than whites. Permanent indentured servitude, chattel slavery, sharecropping, Jim Crow laws, and the war on drugs are all different sides of the same cube that have imprisoned people of color since Europeans began moving out of Europe and into the rest of the world.
Thanks for joining us for another Holden Village podcast. Be sure to view the links in the description for more information or visit our website to find out more about the village. We hope you will make a pilgrimage to Holden. Blessings and peace to you.